Now, this evening is a little bit different. Our normal habit would be to focus on one particular bit of the Bible. This time we're focusing on a particular topic. We're thinking about science and faith. Are they enemies? Has one disproved the other? Well, no. And hopefully we're going to shed a little bit of light on that this evening. Stephen Morris is going to be leading us on that. If you have questions as you go along, those might be things you want to jot down as you go. And if there is time, we'll have a bit of Q&A at the end. If there isn't time, then there'll be an informal bit once everybody else can be, feel free to go. But Stephen will be around to ask questions. Well, he might ask questions, probably more answer them. So there will be a chance for questions either way. So if you're thinking of things as you go along, jot things down and then there'll be a chance to do that. So I'm going to read Psalm 19. And really this psalm is a fantastic hymn of praise, celebrating the world that God has made and the way that he's revealed himself in it and his word as well, which reveals him to us. So let me read these words from Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. But who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer.
Okay, well, thank you for coming along this evening. The subtitle, Why Everything You Know Is Wrong. Well, that's only true if you think that science and faith are opposed to one another and incompatible or anything like that. Hopefully by the end of our time this evening, you'll know that that's not the case. First of all, there are a few preliminaries. The first question you might ask is, who is this guy and what does he know about this subject and why is he able to talk about this? So I don't want to talk about myself, but just to explain a little bit. My background is that I'm a physicist by training. I did a physics degree in Manchester and then a theoretical physics PhD in Cardiff. And my first job on leaving university was with the space industry, working in Pilkington Space Technology in Bodlewyddan on the North Wales coast, making specialized glass components for satellites. And if you want to see something which has been into space and orbited the Earth and been carried back on the space shuttle, you can have a look at these afterwards, because these are some solar cells from the Hubble Space Telescope, which were glass coatings on them were manufactured in Bodlewyddan. They went up onto the Hubble Space Telescope, and after 5 or 10 years, I'm not sure exactly how long, they came to the end of their scheduled life, and the space shuttle went up to put new solar arrays on. The old ones were brought back and they ended up on my desk as a fresh-faced new PhD in Bottlewithens, and I was told to take them off and put them under an electron microscope and see what has happened to them, which was jolly interesting, as you can have a look at that afterwards. After that, I went off to Silicon Valley and worked there for 10 years, and eventually came back, and I've been in science and technology all of my career. Currently, although I live in Shrewsbury, obviously, I work for another Silicon Valley company, and my day job is writing the software which is used to design microchips with. So that's my background, that's my experience. And regarding this presentation that we've got today, again, a couple of bits of background to it. Back 7-8 years ago, that sort of time, I did a number of Tuesday evening sessions, lectures a bit like this. What you're seeing this evening started as one of those, so some of you may well recognize parts of it. If so, I apologize and I hope you won't find it too boring. It's grown a bit along the years, and I've done this particularly in schools with sixth forms where it's been fairly well received, so hopefully you'll find it useful. I'm not going to talk about the whole creation and evolution and cosmology and all that sort of thing. That's just too much material. For what it's worth, my own position is that I'm fully persuaded that the early chapters of Genesis are reliable. I believe that the earth and the universe around it was created by God thousands of years ago rather than millions of years ago, in 6 days, like it says in Genesis, and that what the Bible says about God's creation from that point is true and reliable. That's what I believe, but it's way outside the scope of this evening session to explain all of that. In fact, back in those days when I was doing those presentations, we ended up doing a whole Saturday morning, something like 2.5 hours of me standing on my hind legs, with a break in the middle, I hasten to add, in order to go through that whole subject from end to end. So I'm not going to attempt any of that this evening. What I am going to talk about is, what is faith, what is science, how do the two come together, and what are the consequences of that in practice? So with no further ado, let's press on, assuming that the thing works here. I always struggle with this. Press down. It used to be up. They've changed it. There we go. Okay. So what do we mean by science? And how did science start off? Well, essentially, the most basic definition of science you can have is that people noticed thousands of years ago that the world we live in isn't random. Things don't just happen for absolutely no discernible reason and obeying a no discernible pattern. People have known pretty much since the beginning of time that there are patterns which you can observe, you can understand those patterns, and once you understand those patterns, you can make predictions on the basis of them. And at the very most basic level, that is science. This picture here is Newgrange in Ireland. It's quite close to where the border is nowadays between the north and the south, just on the southern side. But this was built about 5,500 years ago, so it's older than the pyramids. And it's an earthen mound, as you can see, but there is an opening which faces towards the southeast. And once a year, on the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, very shortly after the sun rises, it passes through that opening right into a chamber which is right in the depths, in the very center of that construction. And just on that one day of the year, that chamber deep inside is illuminated by the rising sun on the winter solstice. And not only that, but every 8 years, the light from the planet Venus does exactly the same thing. Now, can you imagine the years of observation which it would have taken to understand that pattern and to be able to predict what was going to happen, and then build this huge structure? I mean, it is huge. It's a very large building, I would guess, a significant proportion of a football pitch in size. That the ancients did that, and to this day, we don't know how they did it. But there we are. So, since ancient times, People have been noticing these patterns, observing them, and understanding them. When we talk about science, we very often move on to talk about technology. The two very often go hand in hand. And we're familiar with the idea that as time goes on and we learn more and more things, we can learn things, we can make predictions. By using those predictions, we can develop new and better things. And so there is this idea of technological progress. I don't expect you to read all the text on this. Don't worry about that. But the point is that from the earliest times, we've gone through the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, Roman times, modern times, and so on. And there is this progression as human beings have learned things and built upon the things that they have learned. And that's one of many things which makes humans unique. The animal world doesn't do this. There are examples in the animal world of animals using tools. We're all familiar with the way in which that a raven can raise the water level in a glass or a bucket or something like that by dropping stones in. There are some examples of other primates, chimpanzees and what have you, using very, very simple sticks as tools. But wherever animals use tools, they've been doing it exactly the same way throughout history. There's never been any advancement, never any progress, never any development. Human beings are unique in doing that. And of course, this doesn't come from nowhere. The Bible itself tells us that there was a time when all these things begun. So in the very early chapters of Genesis here, in Genesis chapter 4, immediately after the world has been created and Adam and Eve have been created and there's a story of Cain and Abel and so on, we read this: Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of all those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all of those who play the harp and the flute. As for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, the instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. So these things, these technologies, they had a beginning, and that the beginning is recorded right in the early chapters of Genesis. And really, everything that we've had since builds up from that beginning as we've gained and learned more and more. In most people's eyes, though, if you went out into the street and asked people who were the first scientists, chances are that they would answer, well, the Greeks, because we associate early science more than anything else with the Greeks. And there we are. And the Greeks knew all sorts of things. They knew, thanks to Pythagoras, about 500 BC, that the square of the hypotenuse on a right-angled triangle is equal to the sum of the squares on the two adjacent sides. They knew, thanks to Aristotle, from about 300 BC, that light always travels in perfectly straight lines. They knew, thanks to Eratosthenes in 200 BC, that the Earth isn't flat, the Earth is a sphere, with a circumference of around about 25,000 miles. Eratosthenes was able to measure that in 200 BC. So if you hear people say that, you know, until recently people believed that the Earth was flat, well, that's not true. Nobody in Europe has believed that the Earth is flat since Roman, since Greek times. Although the Chinese believed that the Earth was flat until about the 16th century. And I'll mention that in brief later on. Anyway, they also knew that that a floating body displaces its own weight of water. Archimedes in 200 BC discovered that. You've probably heard the story which led to him shouting Eureka and jumping out of his bath naked when he realized that this was true. But despite all the things that they knew, there were also things which they thought, but which they were wrong about. So they thought wrongly that the sun and the other planets rotated around the Earth with the Earth at the center. To be fair, there was one chap, Aristarchus, who did suggest that maybe the sun was at the center and the Earth rotated around it, but the other Greeks said, nah, that's silly, And so they forgot all about it and carried on saying that the earth was at the center. I should have pressed that before. Okay, so they believed that the sun and other planets rotated around the earth. They believed that there were only four elements, that everything in the world was made out of earth, air, water, and fire. Now, to be fair, they did pretty well to figure out that there were that everything which we see was made up of different things, but they were wrong about the things that they were made out of. And they were also wrong about the idea that flies and worms and that sort of thing emerged out of nowhere, out of thin air, when things went rotten. Their medical ideas were also very, very bad indeed. But the point that I'm getting round to is that the Greeks, despite being in many ways excellent scientists, they had a very, very high view of human reason. They thought as if something made sense, then it must be true. And if something seemed reasonable to them, then they didn't feel the need to explore any further because they didn't have a concept, essentially, that they might have been wrong about stuff. And that's going to become very important, as we'll see before long. But after the Greeks, there were, of course, the Romans. Now, what can we say about the Romans? Regarding science, absolutely no interest at all. They didn't care. They didn't do any science of value, as far as we know, at all. But they were outstanding engineers despite that, and they based their engineering on some of the knowledge that they inherited from the Greeks. So that's the Pont du Gard in the south of France. That's the Appian Way just outside Rome. That's the Pantheon in Rome, and this is the Segovia Viaduct in Spain. And the Romans were able to do fabulous things in terms of engineering with the relatively small amount of scientific knowledge that they inherited from the Greeks. But then, of course, the other thing which we all know about Rome is that Rome fell. And the effect that this had on, if you like, the Western European psyche is quite important in terms of what happened next. Because Rome went from being this great empire which provided order out of chaos, which provided regularity in daily life for the people who lived within the empire. It all disintegrated. It all disintegrated quite quickly. And what was left behind was chaos and darkness and essentially the Dark Ages. Even simple things like the ability to read and write was largely forgotten, except within the church, which is why, you know, separate subject, we don't want to go into church history now, but really it was only within the church that even such basic things as reading and writing were kept. And of course things went from bad to worse because after Rome had collapsed, it wasn't many centuries before Islam arose in Arabia and quickly spread right across Europe. And you know, we tend to forget now that the interaction between Europe and the Muslim world has been going, isn't a recent thing. It's very, very old. In the 8th century, the Arabs had not only conquered North Africa and Spain, but they had conquered the south of France. And in the late 8th century, they were in 100 miles of Paris before Charles Martel, the king of the Franks at the time, stopped them and turned them back. But it was another 700 years after that before southern France and Spain was finally reconquered. So those in the West who had confidence in their abilities like the Greeks did and confidence in their engineering like the Romans did, that was shattered, went by the board, and really things had to start again. And in particular, much of the knowledge which had come down from the Greeks was altogether lost. In fact, it was only really in Ireland, of all places, strangely, that any knowledge of actually the Greek language and literature was retained at all. And Irish scholars became in demand around Europe because they were able to teach Greek language, Greek ideas, Greek philosophy, and yes, Greek science to those parts of Western Europe which had been where it had been lost. And this guy here, if any of you ever went to Ireland before Ireland adopted the euro and saw an Irish £5 note, then you'd have seen this guy who I always thought he looked a little bit like a walnut whip. You know, he's sort of like a pyramid with something round on top. His name was, in Latin, he was Johannes Scotus. In those days, Scotus meant Irish. That's another story. And he and his contemporaries were the people who reintroduced Greek ideas back into Europe at this time. And what's also interesting is that whereas quite a lot of the original Greek literature had been lost, it turned out while the Arabs were around that the Arabs had actually translated quite a lot of this Greek stuff into Arabic. And in fact, things like the works of Aristotle and Plato and others were rediscovered in Arabic and then translated back from Arabic before the original Greek documents came back to light. So what we've got here is an Arabic copy of a book by Ptolemy, which would have been discovered around about that time, 9th or 10th century, when the original Greek version of it wasn't rediscovered until the 15th century. But I've got the title Scholasticism across the top here. Now, the scholastic movement was really started off by Scotus. I've gone too far. No, I haven't. There we are. So, as these Greek ideas started to become rediscovered, people in Europe thought, this is something great. This is something which we've lost. This is something we'd better reclaim. These Greeks knew what they were talking about. These Greeks knew far, far more about the world than we know. We've lost this Greek knowledge and we must reclaim it. And but then they thought, well, but we're Christians, we also believe the Bible, and all of this Greek stuff doesn't tally with everything in the Bible, so what are we going to do? Well, what they decided to do was they started to try to reconcile Greek knowledge with biblical knowledge. Their own biblical knowledge at that stage of history was often incomplete and defective. But nevertheless, they wanted to meld the two together. And starting with Scotus in the 9th century and going all the way up to this chap, Thomas Aquinas, in the 13th, there was this movement to try to harmonize the biblical teaching with what the ancient Greeks believe. It was very difficult to do because the Bible isn't consistent with what the ancient Greeks believe. And we now know that's because a lot of what the ancient Greeks believed was wrong. But it's an illustration of how actually, at any point in history, if you see that there is some contradiction, apparent or real, between what the Bible teaches and what science is telling you, it's a very, very bad idea to try bending what the Bible says to fit what you think science says, because science moves along. Science changes. New discoveries come to light. New things are noticed. And then, if you have invested all of your credibility in reconciling scripture with the ideas of science at one particular point in history, then you're going to look pretty daft when the science moved on. And that's exactly what happened at the end of the scholastic movement, because the medieval Catholic Church had invested all of its credibility in this movement of harmonizing scripture with Greek philosophy. And then, as we're about to see, the science moved on. But to give them credit, none of that stopped the medievals from inventing the mechanical clock, the printing press, spectacles, telescopes, tidal power, plows, and blast furnaces. All of those things were invented at the same time as this scholastic movement was going on. But the scholastic movement came to a sharp and sudden end when people in the West finally started to gain the confidence to look at the world again for themselves and re-examine the world around them. And perhaps the first of these was Copernicus. Now, you may remember that when I was talking about New Grange right at the beginning, the essence of science is to be able to make observations, understand the principles behind those observations, and on that basis make predictions. And it turns out that if you believe what the Greeks believed, that the Earth is at the center and everything revolves around the Earth, then yes, you can predict things like where a planet's going to be at a particular time and when a particular planet is going to, when Mercury or Venus is going to go across the face of the sun, that sort of thing. You can make the predictions, but it turns out that the maths is really, really difficult and you have to make all sorts of other assumptions and corrections and all that sort of thing. So Copernicus, who lived in Poland in the late 15th century, said, "You know what? Actually, I'm not saying that the sun is really at the center of the solar system. I'm not saying that, but I've noticed that if you just assume for the sake of argument that it is the sun that's at the center of the solar system and everything else revolves around the sun, not around the Earth, then the maths gets much easier." And other people looked at this and said, "You know what? You're right. Actually, the maths does get much easier. Isn't that useful?" And the thing is, because Copernicus didn't go any further than that, because he didn't actually say that the church had been wrong to teach for the last few hundred years that the Earth was at the center of the solar system, nobody cared. It was a case of, "Oh, Copernicus, yes, you've made our lives easier. Jolly good, move on." So few people took any notice. Certainly the Catholic Church didn't take any notice. But then along comes Galileo about a century later. And Galileo was one of the first people to use the newly invented technology of the telescope to make astronomical observations. So telescopes had been around for a while and people had used them to see ships out at sea, ships out at sea and that sort of thing. And Galileo had the bright idea, well, okay, why not point this up and see what we see? And he started seeing things which nobody else had seen before. He spotted, for example, that Venus had phases, and he saw that Jupiter had moved, and he said, "Hang on, you know what, this thing which the church has been teaching for the last few hundred years about the Earth being at the center of the solar system and everything, absolutely everything, revolving around the Earth, that is actually wrong. It's not just that the calculations are easier if we assume it's wrong. It is actually wrong, and therefore the church has been wrong about this." And at that point, the church took a great deal of notice. And a lot of the narrative about the conflict between faith and science really goes back to Galileo. Galileo was much more progressive than Copernicus in pushing his observations. The church accused him of heresy because what he was saying went against church doctrine. After the Pope of the day died, Galileo, who'd agreed to back down initially, once the Pope of the day died, he published a book again, arguing for his point once again. Turns out the new Pope was no more sympathetic to his point of view than the old one had been. Galileo still stuck to his guns, refused to back down, and he was placed under house arrest for the rest of his life, and his books continued to be banned by the Catholic Church until 1758. So the Catholic Church hated science, you might think. Well, actually, no, it didn't. Because despite all of this, the Jesuits, that is to say, the really extremist Catholics who ran the Spanish Inquisition and used to burn Protestants and the stakes and that sort of thing, it turned out that the Jesuits actually took a lot of this stuff on board and became scientists themselves. And I mentioned that the Chinese believed that the Earth was flat until about the late 16th, early 17th century, that sort of time. It was the Jesuits who told them that. And when the Jesuits started making missionary trips to East Asia, the Chinese and the Japanese and people like that listened to them because they brought this new scientific knowledge. So it's all a great deal more complicated than anybody thinks. Anyway, moving on. The Puritans. were people whose chief aim was to understand all that they could about God and to live in the light of that. They believed, as we've seen, that in Psalm 19, that the God reveals himself through the heavens, that the heavens declare the glory of God. And they saw the natural world as, if you like, the second book of God's revelation to us. The Bible was the first book, creation is the second book. And they wanted to understand this because as they saw it, they wanted to think God's thoughts after him. That actual expression comes from Johannes Kepler, who was a German Lutheran who was contemporary with the Puritans. But nevertheless, they wanted to do that. They realized that God had revealed himself through the creation, and they also believed very much that the world was stable and predictable and observable. In other words, they understood that it followed the regular rules that it did because God had ordained those rules, and that God, in establishing a universe which was stable, regular, predictable, was itself a revelation of God's character. So, for example, as well as Psalm 19, one of their proof texts, if you like, would have been Genesis 8:22, when Noah gets off the ark, God tells Noah, as long as the earth endures, sea time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. So they took this very seriously. But they took something else seriously as well, which the Greeks never paid any attention to at all, namely that they, the Puritans, the people who did science, were sinful. So their sin made them, in a word, stupid. It impaired their ability to think rationally. And so rather than having the hubris and confidence that the Greeks had to say, yeah, it makes sense, sure, it's right, they decided that they needed more of a discipline to make sure that they didn't make mistakes because they were sinful human beings and sinful human beings make mistakes. This picture at the bottom here is Francis Bacon. And he was one of the people who developed what we now nowadays call the scientific method. And it's very important to understand what the scientific method is. First of all, you make an observation. You notice something about the natural world, something which you want to explain. And once you've made that observation, you come up with a hypothesis. A hypothesis is an idea that you have where you think, well, this might explain it. This is an idea which may be true or it may not be true, but if it's true, then it offers an explanation for this thing we'd like to explain. At that point, the Greeks would have gone, yeah, that's the explanation, great. But the Puritans said, no, we're stupid human beings. We may well have got this wrong. Psalm 19 contained that line, who can understand his errors? Well, Puritans again took that seriously. So they thought, well, okay, how do we check that we're right? Let's do an experiment. And this was revolutionary. This is the idea of doing experiments is what changed everything. An experiment is very simple. Your hypothesis says that if I do action A, then if my hypothesis is true, then B will happen. If not, then C will happen. So, okay, let's do A, and let's see what happens. Does B happen, or does C happen? So you do it, and you get a result, and then you think, well, hang on, I'm a stupid human being. I might have done the experiment wrong, so I better get somebody else to do the experiment as well. And if they get the same result as I do, then, you know, okay, we're on to something. That essentially is the scientific method. If your idea passes the experiment test, then it's promoted from a hypothesis to being a theory. And you might be thinking in the back of your mind, well, you know, people have told me that evolution is just a theory. Well, you know what? It's not even a theory. It's a hypothesis, because how would you do an experiment to test something which might have happened thousands or millions of years ago? You can't. So within the constraints of the scientific methods, a lot of things which we are told are scientific and are opposed to the Bible and therefore put the Bible and faith at odds with one another. Those things, strictly speaking, aren't even scientific, and the things that they talk about aren't even theories. But anyway, if your hypothesis has passed the test and become a theory, then you use that theory to explain everything which you want to in the natural world, because you can depend upon that theory to make predictions until you can't. And sooner or later, even the best theories are going to find something which they can't explain. And the classic example from the modern period, really, is the orbit of Mercury. So Newton's theories developed in the 17th centuries were perfectly able to explain everything which we see about the motions of the planets and the moon and all the rest of it, except the order of the orbit of Mercury. Mercury just didn't quite fit. Very nearly did, very, very close, but didn't quite. And there were all sorts of theories about what was wrong, why didn't Mercury fit, you know, an invisible planet inside the orbit of Mercury, or maybe Mercury had an invisible moon or something like that. Nobody knew until Einstein came along and developed general relativity. And Einstein didn't develop general relativity in order to explain the orbit of Mercury, but it turned out that because general relativity teaches us about the warping of space-time in the vicinity of a very strong gravitational field, and Mercury, more so than any other planet, was in the sun, was close to the sun, and therefore in the sun's gravitational field, turned out that general relativity perfectly explained the orbit of Mercury. And it turned out that if you were away from the sun, then actually the general relativity equation just reduced to Newton's equations all along. So you get the picture. Anyway, we're going to stop for our break very soon. But I just want to set the scene before we move on, because as a result of that scientific method which had been developed by the Puritans, and to give them credit, their counterparts, the Lutherans in Northern Europe as well, in that period, science and technology, in Protestant Europe particularly, sped ahead at a speed which hasn't been seen before or since. So, William Harvey invented, or rather developed, the circulatory system. He understood that that the heart pumped blood around the body rather than the blood just sort of staying in the parts of the body where it originally was, like the Greek belief, revolutionized medicine. Robert Boyle, 1627 to 1691, he was the first person to properly understand the behavior of gases and was really the father of modern chemistry. Robert Hooke made huge steps forward in the science of materials, in microscopy, in navigation. He invented the pendulum, or rather, at least properly understood the pendulum for the first time and how it could be used to keep time. Isaac Newton, I've mentioned him already. Optics, astronomy, laws of motion, gravitation, fluid mechanics, calculus, the lot. Joseph Priestley, again, gases, in particular the discovery of oxygen and the understanding of how things burnt. He lived 1733 to 1804. Michael Faraday, electricity, magnetism, chemistry, 1791 to 1867. James Clerk Maxwell, 1830 to the 1880s. He gave us electromagnetism and thermodynamics. We wouldn't have radio waves. We wouldn't have television, radio, all that sort of thing without James Clerk Maxwell. William Thomson, Baron Kelvin, understood thermodynamics, how to make a power station efficient, for example. He understood about the science of data, which is used to transmit information over the internet, all that sort of thing. Modern telegraphy, to a large extent, comes from his work. And then outside the UK, these are just the ones who are in Britain, or in Kelvin's case, Northern Ireland. Outside the UK, there was Gottfried Leibniz, who invented topology and worked in geology, Carl Linnaeus, the first serious botanist and zoologist, Alexander von Humboldt from the same period, a great biologist and geologist, Carl Friedrich Gauss, an astronomer, a mathematician, understood magnetism properly for the first time, Ludwig Boltzmann, father of thermodynamics, and just to give an acknowledgement that some Catholics were doing science at this time as well. There was Gregor Mendel, who was the developer of modern genetics as we know it. So it's obvious that the idea, or what I should have said, that any one of these people, if you'd asked them, are you a Christian and do you believe the Bible, they said, yes, of course I am, and yes, of course I do. Particularly Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell, they were very open about the, they were proper evangelicals in the sense that we'd understand it today. So it's obvious that this idea of a conflict between faith and science is complete and utter nonsense. Where did the idea come from? Okay then, let's finish the story. So hopefully it's clear by now. We've in our narrative we're up to well into the 19th century. Oop, let's just go on through what we've just seen. There we are. So we're well into the 19th century now, and it should be obvious now that far from there being a conflict between faith and science, it's actually faith, and more than anything else, the Puritan version of biblical Protestant faith, which gave us science and modern technology and so much that we take for granted in our modern world. So what happened? What went wrong? How did so many people end up with the idea that there was a problem and an inconsistency between the two? The thing is that from its inception in the 17th century, science was a pursuit for gentlemen. There was no government funding, so if you wanted to do science, you had to have time and money of your own. And if you didn't have time and money of your own, then the best thing to do was to teach in a university, because they could give you time and money. But most universities were religious institutions, set up in the first instance almost exclusively for training people for the priesthood. And very often, if you wanted to study or lecture in a university, you first of all had to be ordained into the priesthood. But things were changing, especially in America. And Andrew Dixon White was one of the founders of Cornell University in upstate New York. And this was one of the first entirely secular universities in the US, which particularly was interested in teaching science. Needless to say, he needed publicity. And he was really the first one to confect, for want of a better word, this narrative of a conflict between faith and science. He drew on what we've already heard about Galileo in particular, but most of what he wrote and lectured on contemporary historians nowadays, most of it he made up. It was complete nonsense. But it wasn't only him. There was also this chap called Draper. There we are, John William Draper, who was a distinguished chemist, one of the early pioneers of photography, and he seemed to have had a visceral hatred of Roman Catholicism in particular, which was to do with a family thing. It was to do with his sister who had become a nun and who had handled badly when Draper's son died. But anyway, he really had it in for the Catholic Church in particular. And in 1874, which was the same year as White's lecture, he published a book called The History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Again, he really didn't have anything to go on except Galileo, but nevertheless he padded it out to make a narrative. And I've read into this, I can't find any evidence that those two men colluded with one another or ever even met each other. But the fact that they both simultaneously started saying these things and publishing about them hit a chord in the popular imagination. Remember that in the background, although Darwin didn't originate all of this, his ideas had been sort of circulating for the last 20 years or so. And meanwhile, in theology departments, there were people beginning to question the integrity of the biblical manuscripts, higher criticism, the Tubingen school, all that sort of stuff. And as Victor Hugo put it, nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And by the 1870s, this really was an idea which, despite being nonsense, nevertheless had a receptive audience for whom these guys were saying exactly what they wanted to hear. And nowadays, this whole idea of a conflict between faith and science, amongst historians, this is called the Draper-White thesis, because it was really these two guys who gave rise to it. And really, before the 1870s, even if you had spoken to Darwin or one of his followers, T.H. Huxley and those sorts of people, they wouldn't really have been able to claim that there was this ongoing conflict between faith on one side and science on the other. It all dates from the 1870s, surprisingly. But of course, as time went on, attitudes have hardened. And in the 1950s, there was this guy, C.P. Snow, who talked about there being two cultures, science and humanities, and non-scientists could never understand science, and scientists would never understand the rest of the humanities because they were just alien cultures. In other words, it wasn't only science and faith which were at odds, it was science and the whole of the humanities. That C.P. Snow should have said this was strange because he himself was a distinguished scientist with a PhD in spectroscopy and the author of 15 novels. But there we are. And I mentioned that I had done a version of this talk about 7-8 years ago. And 7 or 8 years ago, I went on from this to go straight from C.P. Snow to what at that time were called the New Atheists, people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and those people, who were claiming on the basis of all of this that, okay, science and faith are in conflict, and therefore to advance science, we need to get rid of faith and get rid of religion and all the rest of it. You know what? It's remarkable how quickly culture can change, because actually, no one takes any notice of the new atheists anymore. New atheism, if I can put it in that sense, is old hat. And the spirit of our own age says something very different, but it's not necessarily more favorable, but it does offer opportunities for us today. So, the current generation of what I will call secular public intellectuals, and I'll come in a moment to the sorts of people I'm talking about, they see faith, and very specifically Christianity, not as the enemy of science and progress, but rather about the only thing which can sustain them in the face of threats which are being made to them. The sort of people I'm talking about, you'll know some of these people, Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray, those guys can fill the O2 arena just by standing up and talking. You know, and they've also sold millions of books. You may well have read some of them. Tom Holland, a historian who has a podcast about history in general, which again, as far as I know, has got millions of listeners. Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a really interesting lady because she was brought up in Somalia as a radical Islamist, became a Dutch MP for a conservative Dutch party, then became a new atheist, and used to share a stage with Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And more recently, about 6 months ago, she wrote an article in a magazine to say why I am now a Christian. And I'm going to quote her because she puts these ideas in a very usefully succinct way. She says, "Western civilization is under threat from three different but related forces. The resurgence of great power authoritarianism, the Chinese Communist Party and Vladimir Putin's Russia, the rise of global Islamism, that hasn't gone away despite everything that's happened, and also the viral spread of woke ideology, which is eating into the moral fiber of the next generation. We can try to fend off these threats with modern secular tools. Military, economic, diplomatic, technological efforts to defeat or bribe or persuade or appease or surveil. And yet every time we do this, we find ourselves losing ground. You can't fight, paraphrasing all of that, you can't fight something with nothing." In her words, the only credible answer, I believe, lies in our desire to uphold the legacy of the Judeo-Christian tradition. So so paraphrasing that. And all of these people and other people like them say very similar things. Ali actually quotes Tom Holland in that same piece. But the thing is this. People who say that, they're right, of course. Christianity gave rise to science as we understand it. The same people who want to undermine Christianity also threaten to undermine and misuse science. But you can't have the fruit without the roots. The modern contemporary philosophical idea is to value the fruits of Christianity because they are the only things which our civilization is based on. But the fruit without the roots, you can't have it. One way that I put it, forgive me if this sounds slightly coarse, but in a culture war, where you're facing up to very aggressive ideas who want to wipe us off the map, going into that with anything less than the gospel itself is like taking a knife to a gunfight. We can't keep the things which are the basis of our current civilization because of a vague desire to protect our Judeo-Christian civilization. No, it doesn't work like that. We need the gospel. And the only thing which is going to protect the civilization which we live in and the progress which we've enjoyed over the last few centuries, the freedoms which we have to practice our faith and the freedom which we have to think and to pursue science and all that sort of thing, that's only going to come from the gospel. And even when the gospel is preached, that's only going to take root when God blesses the preaching of the gospel and blesses it with his Holy Spirit and brings people to faith and brings people to understand these things. So really, in looking at this subject and in just being here in this church, faithfully preaching the gospel from week to week, we are right at the front line of a battle between science and rationality on one hand and chaos on the other. And the fact that we have what we have and the fact that we've had that science has been around and brought us to where we are, that's the grace of God. That's God's gift to us. We need to be thankful for it. I realize I've gone 5 minutes over. I'm very sorry about that. But I'm going to hand back to Nathan now to finish off.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I'm sure there's been lots from that's stimulated our thinking, and hopefully if you have questions off the back of that, maybe sort of, okay, well, what about this? What about that? What do we do next then? Or any questions that we've got, it would be good after we've formally finished this, I'm sure Steve would be around to take any of those questions.